content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. The program today is generously underwritten by White Memorial Presbyterian Church, to whom thanks. They can be reached at 919-834-3424. From The Economist, first of July 6th, Ukraine and Christianity. The Ukraine wants a national church that is not beholden to Moscow. Arguments over church authority could reopen centuries-old wounds. The row is over points of ecclesiastical history and procedure that most people, including ordinary folk who belong to the relevant churches, find utterly obscure. But the geopolitical stakes are enormous. That's one way to describe the escalating dispute over religious authority in Ukraine, a devout and divided country where 70% of people identify as Orthodox Christians. At the root of the argument is a fact that would surprise many people. Although Ukraine is in a state of barely frozen conflict with Russia, the most widely organized Christian church on Ukrainian territory, and the only one which enjoys real international legitimacy, owes allegiance to the Patriarchate of Moscow. Its adherents deny being pawns of Moscow, but they are obliged to offer public prayers for Kirill, Moscow's powerful patriarch. Many Ukrainians feel that as a country battling to preserve its political independence, Ukraine should also have a fully independent national church. As of now, there are two Orthodox bodies which operate on Ukrainian soil, but in part because of Muscovite pressure, neither enjoys any recognition within world Orthodoxy. The larger of these styles itself the Kiev Patriarchate and is headed by a bishop who broke with Moscow's authority in 1992 as Ukraine was consolidating its statehood. None of the 14 self-governing churches that make up global Orthodoxy accepts his title. Tension has been building for several months. On April 9th, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko went to Istanbul and spelled out his aspirations before the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew I, who is considered first among equals in the Orthodox Christian world. Shortly afterwards, an envoy from Kiev formally presented the Istanbul-based patriarch with a request for a grant for autocephaly, in other words, full independence for a newly constituted Ukrainian church. On April 22nd, Patriarch Bartholomew and his advisors gave a careful response. The request was worthy of consideration, but nothing hasty would be done. Having received from ecclesiastical and civil authorities representing tens of millions of Ukrainian Orthodox Christians a petition that requests autocephaly, the Synod decided to communicate closely and coordinate with its sister Orthodox churches. The Moscow Patriarchate's reaction was swift and thunderous. Its forceful external affairs chief, Metropolitan Hilarion Alfeyev, said that if Patriarch Bartholomew accepts the request from Kiev, it could lead to the biggest split in Christianity since 1054, when the Eastern Orthodox Church and Rome parted company. At a minimum, his words implied that relations between the patriarchs of Moscow and Constantinople, the two main poles of authority in Eastern Christianity, could go from scratchy but functional to non-existent. Metropolitan Hilarion has since warned there could be violence if schismatics take control of historically important Ukrainian churches. Among canon lawyers in Moscow, Kiev, and Istanbul, a key point at issue is an event that happened in 1686, giving Moscow authority over a then-flourishing metropolitan see of Kiev. Before that, the Kiev church had answered only to Constantinople, its ultimate spiritual source. For Muscovites, the 1686 Act settles the matter. Their patriarchate is the only legal authority in Ukraine, and if that country was ever to have an independent church, it could only be granted by Moscow. Ukrainians say the 1866 pronouncement was made under duress, and they challenge its legitimacy. Patriarch Bartholomew, always steering a very careful course, said on July 1st that the transfer of authority to Moscow in 1686 had not been unconditional, and that his own ancient see retained a legitimate interest in the affairs of Ukraine. Mr. Poroshenko has told his supporters that their dream of a legitimate national church could be realized by July 28th, which is the 1030th anniversary of the conversion to Christianity of the Eastern Slavs. According to tradition, this event followed a journey to Constantinople by Slavic envoys who were so overwhelmed by the beauty of the worship there that they, quote, did not know whether they were in heaven or earth. But Patriarch Bartholomew, whose relations with relations in Moscow have fluctuated sharply since he took office in 1991, will think very carefully before making any final adjudication on the religious affairs of today's Slavs. The earthly stakes, as well as the heavenly ones, are high. And to the religion news service now of July 13th. Rebuilding with U.S. funds, Iraq's minority religious communities still await security. Last fall, as coalition troops broke through the last major strongholds held by the so-called Islamic State, Vice President Mike Pence delivered a speech to the advocacy group In Defense of Christians in Washington, D.C. In what attendees said was an unexpected move, he focused a sizable portion of his remarks on attacking United Nations efforts to assist Iraqi minority religious groups whose ancient ancestral homes were ravaged by the militants. Our fellow Christians and all who are persecuted in the Middle East should not have to rely on multinational institutions when America can help them directly, Pence said. And tonight, it is my privilege to announce that President Trump has ordered the State Department to stop funding ineffective relief efforts at the United Nations. Instead, Pence said, the Iraqi communities would receive support directly from the U.S. Agency for International Development to help them rebuild. The move was celebrated by evangelical leaders in the United States, for whom the restoration of Iraq's Christian community is a key foreign policy goal. But most parties involved say they are increasingly concerned that even the most successful rebuilding program faces a more vexing issue, security. U.S. aid, which has already spent approximately $700 million in humanitarian assistance for all of Iraq since 2014, unveiled a broad agency announcement soon after Pence's speech, expediting the process of granting funds to local non-governmental organizations. In December of 2017, USAID directed $6.6 million in funds for direct assistance to internally displaced people returning to Nineveh province, where, according to the Washington Post, fewer than 200,000 Christians survive in a region that once hosted some 1.5 million. It also aided those returning to nearby Sinjar, where Yazidis have also seen their numbers dwindle, with only 500,000 left. The State Department gave an additional $10 million specifically for Iraq's religious minorities, the newspaper reported. A month later, USAID made a $75 million installment to the United Nations Development Program, stipulating that $55 million of it should be allotted to serve religious minorities. The funding shift was meant to help reestablish the communities after widespread atrocities emptied out villages and towns across northwestern Iraq. When the Islamic State began waging their campaign of terror in 2014, the world watched in horror as Yazidis, Christians, Shabaks, and other religious minorities in the region were singled out by the infamously brutal group. Crucifixions, sexual slavery, and systematic rape were used as weapons of war, as were wholesale destruction of homes. The militants would put all the furniture inside the house, then splatter graffiti all over the place, destroy the wiring, rip out the plumbing, said Bill O'Keefe, Vice President for Government Relations for Catholic Relief Services, recalling a recent trip to areas once populated by Iraq's religious minorities. The level of cruelty at that human level is overwhelming. The scale of the targeted killings was so extreme that then-Secretary of State John Kerry declared it genocide in 2016, a rare official distinction that encouraged the United Nations to take action. But the declaration also lends further justification for the White House's decision to shift funding directly to the minority communities. The World Bank and the Iraqi government estimate that rebuilding communities destroyed by the Islamic State, which is also known as ISIS, will cost about $88 billion. O'Keefe said he observed locations where the Islamic State torched every house. It's unclear, however, whether any amount of rebuilding orchestrated by the Iraqi government, USAID, CRS, or numerous other groups will convince the historical residents to return in the near or distant future. Philippe Nassif, executive director of In Defense of Christians, told Religion News Service that while some towns are policed by remaining residents or Yazidi or Christian militias, many are being guarded by the forces that reclaimed them from the Islamic State, including Shiite Muslim militias backed by Iran. "It's a huge concern," Nassif said. "There's no point in rebuilding all those areas unless they're safe." Nassif expressed frustration with those who, quote, blame Muslims hating Christians, and insisted the backdrop for the militia issue is an ongoing political standoff Middle Eastern Christians know all too well, namely the proxy war being waged between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Nassif argued that the biggest losers when these forces go head-to-head are the small communities that are already caught in the middle, and that the U.S. should push the Iraqi government to rectify the situation. "It's a matter of whether this administration is going to look at the Iraqi government and its decision-makers in the eye and say, don't mess this up." Haider Elias, president of the Yazidi advocacy group Yazda, agreed, noting, "The population is too scared to go among these groups." He added that security for human beings is number one. Yazidis and Christians have lived in Kurdistan for 4 years now, and they have a connection to the community. They're not in a rush to go back. The White House is aware that security issues are paramount, according to officials, and say Pence is keeping a close eye on the project. In late June, USAID Administrator Mark Green and Sam Brownback, the U.S. Ambassador at Large for International Religious Freedom, went on a fact-finding mission to Iraq. Green personally reported their findings to the vice president. A USAID official said that Green and Brownback observed the problem firsthand and that practically everybody they talked to talked about the security issue. A Pence aide would only say that the vice president was, quote, pleased with Green's assessment. On July 5th, after talking to Green, Pence tweeted, "America is committed to restoring historic Christian communities in the region ravaged by terrorism and war," alongside an image of the vice president and the USAID administrator talking. It's not clear, however, what headway, if any, Green or Brownback made regarding the issue during their Iraq visit. The official report on the trip noted only that the delegation met with government leaders from Baghdad and the Kurdistan regional government, including Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, to discuss actions being taken by the government of Iraq to better support these vulnerable populations. A Pence aide told RNS on Thursday, July 12th, that the administration is keenly aware of security issues in Iraq and is, quote, engaged with Iraqi leaders and other countries to continue collaborative efforts to suppress ISIS and counter nefarious influences in the country, including rogue militias, though the official did not offer specific details. Solutions are scarce. Nassif was dismissive of sending federal troops and only tentatively floated the idea of a UN interim force to help secure the region. Others expressed interest in pushing for the militias to be somehow replaced with armed police forces made up of members from the religious minority groups themselves. Meanwhile, some have said that, given the scope of the problem, USAID's largesse won't answer the dire need. Even after Pence's announcement, local non-governmental organizations complained that they were being denied grants from USAID due to red tape. Others grumbled that the agency didn't announce an additional $10 million in funds for various projects until June. Both USAID officials and Pence aide say more money is coming. "The long-term recovery of these communities is going to be generational," said a USAID official. And from the Associated Press now, of July 11th, "The boys are out of the cave, and now Hollywood wants in." The producers behind Christian films like God's Not Dead are already in Thailand with plans to develop a movie about the 18-day saga of the soccer team trapped in a flooded cave. Though the drama of headline-grabbing rescues often doesn't carry over to the big screen, Pure Flix Entertainment co-founder Michael Scott believes the story about the 12 boys and their 25-year-old coach is ripe for movie adaptation. "We realized that this would make an incredibly inspiring movie," Scott said Wednesday, July 11th, speaking by phone from Thailand. "Like a lot of people, we know there's not a lot of positive news in the world today." Scott said he feels a personal connection with the story. His wife is Thai, and he said he was spending the summer in Bangkok when the soccer team went missing. Scott and fellow producer Adam Smith recently traveled to the area around the cave in northern Thailand, and they had begun talking to some of the participants about their, quote, life rights. But they also stressed that they aren't yet pursuing most of the families of the boys, who on Wednesday remained recuperating in a hospital. "For us, it's not a huge race," said Smith. "It's about making sure we get the authenticity right." Many hurdles await them. Most films that enter development never get produced, and the producers are just beginning to seek a screenwriter. Other film production companies will surely show interest, and they could leapfrog ahead with a larger production. And while the Arizona-based Pure Flix has found some success with low-budget Christian films, The Case for Christ, and conservative documentaries like Hillary's America, The Secret History of the Democratic Party, it's far from a Hollywood heavyweight. Others in TV and film are already looking to capitalize. Discovery has scheduled a one-hour documentary special to debut Friday. But Pure Flix hopes it can beat any fiction film rush. "I don't think this is a religious film," said Scott. "I think it's an inspirational film." There's also some reason to doubt the box office appeal of the tale. Ripped from headlines, movies have not been setting the world on fire. Although Clint Eastwood's Sully was a success, his 2018 docudrama about the 2015 Thalys train attack, The 1517 to Paris, disappointed. Michael Bay's 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi, in 2016, was the director's worst-performing release. Peter Berg's 2016 big-budget drama about the 2010 oil rig explosion, Deepwater Horizon, likewise fizzled. The best comparison would be 2015's The 33, about the 2010 mining disaster in Chile that trapped 33 miners for 2 months. Though boasting a starry cast of Antonio Banderas, Josh Brolin, and Juliette Binoche, it barely made a blip at the box office with $24 million worldwide. And back to The Economist now of July 9th. A giant of Vatican diplomacy, Jean-Louis Touraine, opposed the Gulf War and mended fences with Islam. His fears for the Christian population of the Middle East proved well-founded. The months leading up to the Anglo-American assault on Saddam Hussein in 2003 produced some tense moments in diplomacy of the religious as well as the secular sort. To the dismay of American conservatives, especially Catholic ones, the ailing Pope John Paul II was unequivocal in his opposition to any recourse to war. By one count, the pontiff made this point at least 56 times. Among those leading the Vatican's diplomatic charge was a French prelate, then styled as Archbishop Jean-Louis Touraine, the Holy See's Secretary for Relations with States. At one point, he told 174 foreign envoys accredited to the Vatican that, quote, "a war of aggression would be a crime against peace." Since Iraq had not, at least since the 1991 ceasefire, perpetrated an armed attack against anyone, any invasion of that country by one or more states would amount in legal and moral terms to a campaign of aggression, the Archbishop added. The use of force should only be a last resort, undertaken in strict conformity with the rules of the United Nations, and it was absolutely clear, in this French cleric's view, that the circumstances permitting a recourse to armed force against Iraq did not exist. The Bush administration dispatched a respected Catholic philosopher, Michael Novak, to Rome to argue the case for the legitimacy of preventative war against a dangerous pariah state. But the people at the Vatican, including the Frenchman who led its diplomatic branch, remained utterly unconvinced. On July 5th, Cardinal Turan died, age 75. He won posthumous praise, and in some quarters posthumous criticism, for both the big jobs he had done. Between 1990 and 2003, he served as Vatican Foreign Minister. And in 2007, he assumed the leadership of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, a duty he continued to shoulder, despite being stricken with Parkinson's disease throughout his tenure. In the second job, his most delicate task was to manage the Vatican's relationship with the world of Islam. He was seemingly indefatigable. In April, he led a Vatican delegation to Saudi Arabia, and the following month, he marked the start of a Ramadan by declaring that Christianity and Islam must move from, quote, a spirit of competition to one of collaboration. Although it was proper to recognize the differences between the two religions, it was also important for Christians and Muslims to remember the religious and moral values they shared. The two parts of his career were, in fact, closely linked. As will be recalled by anyone who was around the Vatican in the Gulf War period, the Holy See's opposition to the Iraq War was motivated not only by general principles. It also reflected a feeling that Christians in Iraq and the surrounding region would be doomed if the idea took hold that there was a binary opposition between the historically Christian West and the historically Muslim Middle East. Muslims who were enraged by America's intervention in their region would surely take their revenge on the people in their own neighborhood who practiced a Western religion, in other words, Christians. From this point of view, it was worthwhile for the Vatican to denounce the Iraq War, even if there was little hope of its words being heeded in Washington, D.C. Whether successful or not, strong words from the Holy See would help to dispel the impression that the entire Christian West was lining up to impose its will on the lands where Islam prevailed. Unfortunately, the Vatican's fears proved to be well-founded. In Iraq, for example, the number of Christians has fallen to under 300,000 and maybe much fewer, from 1.3 million before the 2003 war. Cynics would say the sort of emollient language that Cardinal Turan used when addressing Islam did little to protect vulnerable Christian minorities. He would probably have retorted that these minorities would not now be so vulnerable if it had not been for the heavy-handed actions of the West. On July 7th, Pope Francis convened a meeting in the Italian port of Bari for Christian leaders with flocks in the Middle East and urged them to overcome their quarrels and doctrinal differences to work together for the welfare and survival of their embattled communities. Whatever the causes, the battle for survival is probably an accurate description. Then at least one French bishop felt so strongly about that battle that he continued the struggle even when he was fighting a losing war against ill health. And from the Associated Press now, July 11th, a letter written nearly 500 years ago by Martin Luther, in which he refers to Jews as devils incarnate during a tirade against a former ally, is up for auction. But Luther scholars warn that the man responsible for the Reformation should not be called anti-Semitic. The single-page letter, with writing on both sides, is expected to sell for at least $300,000 at an auction being conducted by Boston-based RR Auction that concludes Wednesday. Martin Luther items don't come to auction often, and this is incredibly great shape for a 500-year-old letter, said Robert Livingston, RR's executive vice president. The letter was written around September 1543 to a top official at Berlin's St. Nicholas Church in response to a letter from that official requesting Luther's interpretation of some biblical verses by which former Luther friend Johann Agricola justified his positive treatment of Jews in what is now Germany. In his reply, Luther tells George Holzer, that he has done well to preach against the Jews, and he should continue to do so, ignoring Agricola, whom Luther accused of being a habitual liar. "For these Jews are not Jews, but devils incarnate who curse our Lord," Luther wrote, according to RR's auction's translation. Luther, whose 95 theses in 1517 triggered the Protestant Reformation and seismic rift in Christianity that still exists, sympathized with Jews early on because of the poor way they were treated by the Catholic Church, said Eric Mexitas, author of the 2017 book Martin Luther. There is no doubt that Luther had strong negative feelings about Jews later in life when he was cranky and sick, said Mexitas, but he cautioned against comparing 16th century anti-Semitism with 21st century anti-Semitism. We don't mean what Luther would have meant by it, he said. Luther became frustrated that Jews would not convert to his version of Christianity. Later in his life, after he had, in a sense, re-presented the Christian faith the way he thought it should be presented, he was depressed and discouraged by the fact that many Jews of that era did not, in fact, accept this free gift of grace through Jesus. Europe had a long history of mistreating Jews, said Christopher Boyd Brown, an associate professor of church history at Boston University. Luther plays a part in this grim history, Brown said via email. Yet as appalling as Luther's intolerance of his Jewish contemporaries was, Luther was not an anti-Semite. His criticism of Judaism was rooted in theological disagreement over the reading of shared scriptures, not in racial animus. Luther denounced medieval Christian charges that Jews were responsible for the death of Jesus and was a strong voice for nonviolent religious tolerance, Brown said. The letter, which includes a leather clamshell case, is likely to be sold to a museum or private collector who will know how properly to preserve it, Livingston said. Lost to history until 1914, when it was discovered in a private collection of a German baron, it is being sold by a German document collector. And finally, again from the Associated Press of July 13th, prosecutors say a Texas man accused of torching a mosque made plans to create a, quote, rogue unit to monitor and possibly confront Muslims at the Islamic Center. Mark Vincent Perez is on trial for federal arson and hate crime charges for the 2017 fire that destroyed a mosque in Victoria, Texas, about 120 miles southwest of Houston. On Tuesday, jurors saw private messages and Facebook posts that prosecutors say show Perez's dislike and suspicion of Muslims. They also heard from a federal investigator who said Perez's phone contained 4 photos of the burning mosque. Perez has said he was not involved in the blaze. According to the Express News, defense attorney Mark DiCarlo hinted that alibis may be presented later in the trial, which is expected to last 2 weeks. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. Thanks very much for listening. We're sponsored again by White Presbyterian Memorial Church, who can be reached at 919-834-3424. Michael Blakely here. Thanks very much for listening. I'll talk to you later.